Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Turkish state media says fighting escalated after Turkish ground forces crossed the border into a Syrian Kurdish enclave. Reuters Scarlett Svetanovic reports.
Operation Olive Branch pits Turkey against Kurdish fighters allied to the United States at a time when ties between Ankara and Washington appear close to breaking point. Turkey sees the YPG as an extension of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. They previously carried out a deadly long-term insurgency in Turkey's mainly Kurdish southeast. The United States is backing the YPG in Syria, seeing it as an effective partner in the fight against Islamic State.
Afghan commando forces have ended an overnight siege at Kabul's Intercontinental Hotel that resulted in the deaths of at least 16 people, including foreign nationals. An Interior Ministry spokesman confirmed only 5 deaths, including foreigners, and 9 injured in the attack that began late Saturday on the Intercontinental Hotel in the Afghan capital. KAM Airlines says 10 of its staff were killed in the militant raid, including 5 pilots and 14 other employees are missing. 2 Venezuelans and a number of Ukrainians are reported to be among the victims. The siege lasted nearly 14 hours, during which all 5 assailants either blew themselves up or were gunned down by Afghan forces. Honduran security forces clashed with demonstrators Saturday in the capital and across the country. They were protesting the results of a disputed election that returns President Juan Orlando Hernandez to office. Police and soldiers were deployed across the country where protesters blocked streets. At least 1 person was killed during the clashes. This is VOA News. Blaming each other for the political deadlock, Republican and Democratic lawmakers closed their meetings on the first day of a partial shutdown of the U.S. government, with few signs of agreement on a spending bill, tangled in a fight over immigration. Steve Hines and his family are at Yellowstone National Park, where he expressed disappointment in U.S. lawmakers.
It's kind of political posturing, I believe. It's been that way for a few years, at least this last year. Which I'm for one, I'm tired of the immature actions that we see in politics. What we need is some good statesmen.
The U.S. government has shut down before, including in 2013, in a partisan deadlock over health care policy and funding. The word is that there might be another vote early Monday to extend a decision on the federal budget. During his second stop on his 4-day Middle Eastern tour in Jordan, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence addressed the government shutdown in the states and the issue of government employees not getting paid.
So know this, your president, your vice president, and the American people are not going to put up with it. We're going to demand that they reopen the government. In fact, we're not going to reopen negotiations on illegal immigration until they reopen the government and give you, our soldiers, and your families the benefits and wages you've earned.
Also, while there, Jordan's King Abdullah expressed his concern about Washington's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel in talks with Vice President Pence. The king told the vice president that the only solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a two-state solution, and that East Jerusalem must be the capital of a future Palestinian state. The mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, said more than 120,000 protesters turned out in Manhattan to attend the day's March for Women's Rights, as hundreds of thousands of others did in cities around the country.
The president's going to have to listen. When you see this kind of grassroots outpouring, it means a lot. And you're certainly going to see more of it throughout this year. Anyone who thinks it was a one-hit wonder is wrong. That what happened a year ago was the beginning of a bigger movement.
The Women's March 2018 took place on the anniversary of the inauguration of President Donald Trump, and many of Saturday's demonstrators expressed displeasure with him in their signs and apparel, which included a double-pointed pink hat made popular last year by an off-color remark Mr. Trump made on tape years before winning the presidency. The women gathered to call for equal rights and pay, health care, and denounce sexual harassment. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Country is actually ecstatic at this point in time. There's enthusiasm. The people are very hopeful. It's a very beautiful, evolving, colorful occasion.
Liberians prepare for the inauguration of President-elect George Weah with a church service Sunday.
I have seen in the past that most people move to the ruling party with a hope of getting a better future for themselves.
A prominent Zambian government critic defect to the ruling party.
Yes, it is true that the president has requested us all to go for care because we are experiencing intermittent rainfall and we don't want to experience drought because we rely on the rain.
And Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika calls for 3 days of prayer for good rains. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A church service was held Sunday in preparation for the inauguration of Liberian President-elect George Weah, who is scheduled to be officially installed president Monday. He was declared winner of the presidential election runoff with 61% of the vote to defeat Vice President Joseph Boakai. Mr. Weah takes over from outgoing President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in a ceremony to be held in the capital, Monrovia. Meanwhile, Weah moved to dispel accusations he is ill-prepared to take the reins of the fragile West African country and said his priority will be maintaining peace. For more about plans for the inauguration, I read Janga Kowo, Secretary General for the Liberian Congress for Democratic Change Party.
Well, today is a very unique occasion as it's the National Thanksgiving and Intercessory Service for the inauguration of our Senator Ambassador George Manuel Weah, President-elect of the Republic of Liberia, and Senator Joy Howard Taylor, Vice President-elect of the Republic of Liberia. This program is being held at the historic Centennial Memorial Pavilion on Ashmore Street in Monrovia.
What are preparations so far ahead of Monday's official inauguration of George Weah and his Vice President, Joel Howard Taylor?
Well, basically, a lot of foreign dignitaries and the head of foreign governments are beginning to arrive in Liberia, representatives of international organizations and the sub-region ECOWAS. They are all beginning to arrive in the country. The country is actually ecstatic at this point in time. There's enthusiasm. The people are very hopeful. It's a very beautiful, evolving, colorful occasion, and marking the inauguration of this historic and beautiful son of our country.
Will Liberia be ready to host all these African heads of state who will be arriving to participate in the ceremony?
Yes, the country, there's a lot of logistical and protocol arrangements being put in place for the accommodation of these international guests. Yeah, all hands are on deck. There's a national committee on the inauguration that is working to ensure that all of our guests are well taken care of, that the program is in fact is very, very good. And so we can tell you, yes, that the plans are on the way. The arrangements are moving very, very well. The protocol, everything is in place. So far, so good. We are very hopeful that these activities are going to go very well.
Janga, this will be the first time in a very long time that Liberia will be having a smooth transition from one democratically elected leader to the next. How are Liberians reacting to Monday's transition from Madam President to George Weah?
Yeah, this is a historic occasion. It's a demonstration of the consolidation of the democratic credentials of Liberia. And Liberians are very hopeful. As you may be aware, the country went through 14 years of civil conflict in addition to the 12 years of a peaceful governance under Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So this transition is the first democratic transition from a sitting president to the next in more than 70 years. So this indeed historic And in fact, it's a learning process, as a matter of fact, because there are no historical records as to how this kind of situation has been handled. But I can tell you, you know, a dedicated team of Liberians are working around the clock to ensure the smooth transition of power from the Unity Party-led government to the Coalition for Democratic Change, CDC, government in Liberia. Yes, the people are very hopeful. The people are very, you know, anticipatory. As you may be aware, President Weah was elected on a very huge mandate. He got 60%, more than 60% of the votes in the runoff election. So that is the kind of mandate that he's coming to with to the presidency. So indeed, this is a historic occasion. Liberians are very, very hopeful. They are anticipating that indeed President Weah will take those necessary steps in the governance process of the country that will impact the life of the people. And President Weah himself has indicated that he's running a pro-poor agenda. There's a pro-poor revolution that Liberian people undertook. So you can be assured that indeed the Liberian people will be better served on Senator George Manuel Weah and Senator Dwight Howard Taylor.
Well, other opposition politicians who lost during the last presidential election and subsequently the runoff be part of this inauguration ceremony Monday?
Yeah, definitely. As a matter of fact, the losing candidate, Vice President Joseph Yuman Boakai, has congratulated President-elect Weah. In fact, yesterday, President-elect Vice President Joseph Yuman Boakai, along with his wife, paid a courtesy visit on President-elect George Weah and Madam Clara Weah at their residence. So you can see the consolidation of the peace, the reconciliation process, and we look forward to seeing a constructive opposition to our CDC government.
Janga Kowo is the Secretary General for the Liberian Congress for Democratic Change Party. He spoke with me from Monrovia. A prominent member of the Zambian Opposition Forum for Democracy and Development, or FDD, has defected to the ruling party Patriotic Front. Until his defection, Antonio Mwanza, who was the spokesperson for the FDD, was a sharp critic of President Edgar Lungu's government. Announcing his defection, Mwanza said he defected to the ruling party because he does not want to grow old in opposition politics. Officials welcomed him at a ceremony held at the ruling party's headquarters in the capital, Lusaka. For reaction, I reached Edith Nawakwi, founder and leader of the opposition FDD party.
Well, as you rightly say, he has defected to the ruling party. The nature of African politics and Zambian politics particularly is that it's very difficult for people to brave it in the opposition where there is no financing. So people tend to gravitate towards the highest bidders. I think that at this stage of life, he's young, he has a family, as he has stated in his message to me, that he has a duty to his family to be able to support his family. And I take it that people see African politics, especially politics of ruling parties, as a place where people can earn a livelihood. He will not be the first one to leave the party, and nor will he be the last. In the last 3 years since he came from the opposition UPND to us, we gave him a very prominent platform. And no one would deny the fact that his prominence has been because we did provide him that platform of being spokesperson for FDD.
Ms. Nawakwi, are you saying that a lot of Zambian politicians play or are into politics of the belly? And in this case, Mwanza is following suit?
Well, I mean, for what he has said, that he has a duty to his family, I interpret it that it is difficult in the opposition where there is no salary, there is no stipend, there is no way of making money other than when you are in the ruling party. I take it that that is one of the motivating reasons, because that's why I'm referring to what he has he said to me is the reason. I have seen in the past that most people move to the ruling party with a hope of getting a better future for themselves.
Well, wouldn't that be detrimental to Zambia's democracy because your party plays a prominent role to act as a check on their administration? If there is massive defections as we are seeing now or cross-carpeting, Zambia's democracy could be in peril.
I think the best answer to that is a young child who says to me that, look, who is going to stand up for Zambia? Because even young people who are not yet in politics can almost read into politicians who like to move from one party to the rest. But the truth is that no one heard about Mr. Mwanza until we gave him that prominence. We've worked together very well. The party will miss him. But the truth is that does FDG have an income to pay stipend for its workers? The simple answer is no. And if anyone says that the reason is because of leadership, that's not the case. I personally have been in the opposition for over 20 years now. I can proudly say that among us Zambian politicians, I have come to note a lot of them who were members of FDD. They either moved to MMD when we lost as FDD. From MMD, they moved to PF, and there are many of those. And that's the way Zambian politics is. People move from one party to the rest, this way and that way. And democracy, as you rightly say, is in danger because it's hard to run opposition politics in Africa.
Are you a bitter politician? Because Mwanza said he decided to join the PF because he did not want to belong to a group of bitter politicians.
No, I'm not. You need to know that UPND as a party itself, they lost their vice president, Mr. Kapita, to the ruling party. He's now minister in one of the provinces. I think that would answer your question. I'm not bitter. I would like to be very honest and say he did his lap. We wish him well. And as a young person, I hope that and pray that he has made a decision which is correct and long-term. That's all I can say.
Are you concerned that supporters of your party who looked up to him, he was sharply critical of the administration, now he joins the ranks of the ruling PF party. Are you therefore concerned that some of your supporters will follow him as such?
I want to say this, that for the past 16 or so years, I've been very steadfast in the opposition. Many people will follow FDD, not necessarily because of the spokesperson or because of they follow FDD policies. We have the best policies in the country of decentralization. And many people look up to me, and that's why they're in the opposition. You would be worried if it is in our work we hang up the gloves, and then you'd say, well, what next?
Edith Nawakwi is the founder and leader of the Zambian opposition FDD party. She spoke with me from Lusaka. Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika has called for 3 days of prayer, which began on Friday to end on Sunday. The president asked citizens to pray for good rains and a productive agricultural season. In a statement, Mutharika asked cabinet ministers and all senior government officials to lead prayer vigils at mosques and churches. His call comes as the country grapples with a dry spell and worsening pest infestation threatening the country's staple maize crop. For more on the president's call in this deeply religious nation, I reached Malawian Information Minister Nicholas Dausi in the capital Lilongwe on his way to church.
Yes, it is true that the president has requested us all to go for prayers because we are experiencing intermittent rainfall and we don't want to experience drought because we rely on the rain. So this from Friday, Saturday and Sunday, we want to make sure that people have gone for prayers. We trust the prayers will help us to have more rains.
But some people are saying that prayers should be accompanied with pragmatic policies with rain conservation and irrigation. What do you say to that?
Well, pragmatism in making sure there are rains. I don't know what pragmatism can bring rains. But I think that, yes, we are trying hard to bring back the natural resources, that is replanting of trees, taking care of the trees, not wanting them cutting down. So that we are doing, and we think it will mitigate the weather patterns.
Some of his critics are saying that instead of coming up with irrigation policies to boost agricultural production, he's asking for rain or praying for rain, which is not an antidote, they said, to failed policies to boost agricultural production. What do you say to that?
Well, they're entitled to their opinion, but I think what you are doing is the right one.
How are Malawians responding to the president's call for national prayers?
There has been a unanimous call. In any case, Malawi is a God-fearing nation. There are Christians, Muslims, various denominations. So any mention of the need to pray before God is always met with unanimous response. And we believe and trust in God that everything is possible with God. And we started on Friday.
Those who are non-Christians, Muslims and other religious groups, what happens to them with this directive?
The call starts from Friday. Friday is where people go to the mosques, and these are Muslims. Whether they are Hindus, whether they are whatever denomination, but whoever trusts in God will surely kneel down to God to ask for rains.
Now, the president called for that, but is he leading by example, Mr. Dawsey?
Yes, he's leading for example. He's a Presbyterian. For your information, Presbyterians don't go and pray on Friday. They pray on Sunday.
After the prayers, what happens next, Mr. Dawsey?
You know what? At first, to mitigate the weather or climate change, which has resulted because at least our people have cut trees wantonly, we are encouraging every Malawian to plant trees. We are getting the example, you know, after the Second World War in 1945, Konrad Adenauer encouraged these people to plant more trees, and Germany now is green. So why don't Malawi do the same? We're encouraging our people to plant more trees. In fact, other people are planting Pasparam Natatam. So everybody is planting trees here. And then we would want also people to make sure that they don't encroach the river banks, because our electricity is hydro. It means it's water generated. And that is really something that we want to make sure that Malawi is green, the vegetation is there to attract more rains.
What is the message to the Malawians following the president's call for prayers?
The long-lasting call is that every Malawian should plant not less than 10 trees and take care of them. No Malawian should cut tree in the river banks, and we must preserve the trees that we have. We must have a good policy on natural resource preservation. We would want to make Malawi, it's already beautiful, but we want to make it more greener. And that is a long-term objective. And we want also to make sure that we have harvested water so that we can use it for irrigation. And then also the need to take care of our hydropower stations once we harvest water, the water will be flowing all the whole year so that we don't have the intermittent blackouts. But surely climate change is something that is hitting every country, and it's a talk that we must embrace to make sure that Malawi is green and the rains are coming.
Nicholas Dawsey is the Malawian Information Minister. He spoke with me from Lilongwe. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says it welcomes Ethiopia's decision to release 115 detainees, including several leading political figures. But it says the government should free all those imprisoned for holding opposing opinions. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The Ethiopian government imposed a state of emergency in October 2016. That followed deadly anti-government protests by the Oromo and Amhara ethnic groups, who are pressing for greater freedom. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell tells VOA about 20,000 people were arrested during the state of emergency, which was lifted in August 2017. She says a number of people subsequently have been released, but the number of people still in detention remains high.
That's why we are welcoming the moves by the government to start releasing people, and we're welcoming the comments that the government and the Prime Minister have made with regard to setting up reviews for people who can be released, also setting up task forces to look into reported killings.
Throssell says her office also welcomes the government's decision to discontinue cases against some 400 other detainees. However, she says she's concerned that certain categories of prisoners will not be eligible for release. These include people suspected of murder, causing injury, destruction of infrastructure, and attempting to overthrow the constitutional order by force.
We appreciate the seriousness of some of the offences that may have been committed, but we urge the government to review these conditions to ensure that they are neither interpreted nor implemented too broadly, thereby resulting in people being arbitrarily or wrongfully detained.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the Ethiopian government to bring its anti-terrorism legislation and laws regarding civil society and the media in line with international human rights law and principles. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And a new report released says the four-year conflict in South Sudan has negatively impacted many school-aged adolescent girls. The report says the critical level of food insecurity in the country forces households to resort to employing a number of bad options, such as forcing their daughters into early marriages or prostitution in exchange for dowry or cash. For VOA, Waki Simon Wudu has the story from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
The report released this week by aid agency Plan International is called The Journey of Adolescent Girls During and After Armed Conflict in South Sudan. It says adolescents, especially girls, often have to overcome several challenges in order to attend school, such as higher risks in sexual and reproductive health, which often affects their education. The report also states that many households are unable to afford treatment for their adolescent children who suffered sexual violence or problems associated with the early marriage. In fact, says the report, two-thirds of South Sudanese adolescents interviewed cannot access medical facilities, and those who can often do not receive the medication they need due to drug shortages. Fortson Kafeko, Plan International's interim country director for South Sudan, says all of these challenges are exacerbated by the ongoing conflict.
The things that have come out, issues to do with access to education, issues to do with coping mechanisms, some of them going into prostitution, some of them being married off at the tender age, some of them really having to sell off some of the grain that they have had.
Kafeko says adolescent girls often experience multi-layered insecurity in their day-to-day lives relating to health care, lack of food, and no education because their schools were destroyed. The report's findings are based on a research the agency conducted last year to investigate the impact of the armed conflict on adolescent girls in the five counties of Torit, Yei, Juba, Magui, and Lainya, all in the Equatorial region. The researchers spoke to 249 adolescent girls, activists, and community leaders, and conducted 24 focus group discussions to understand the impact of the armed conflict on the health, education, and protection of adolescent girls. William Ater, advisor to South Sudan's Ministry of Education, says government efforts to address the challenges outlined in the report have been hampered by the continued fighting. He says unless peace is restored, the situation will not change anytime soon.
We still have 1.8 children who are out of school. We wanted at least 1 million of these 1.8 to be enrolled in the schools by 2022. We wanted a quality education to be established, a curriculum in place. We wanted to make sure that the equity and equality is implemented in the field of education.
Kurere Susan, who works for Oxfam, urged government officials to do more to address the challenges affecting girls' education in South Sudan. Susan also urged Plan International to expand their research.
When we looked at the research was conducted in particular areas, that is particularly in Equatoria, so I would suggest that next time it will be better for Plan International to concentrate on other areas like Greater Upper Nile or Greater Barkazal, whereby we also have most of the girls who are being really affected by this conflict in South Sudan.
The report recommends training community health workers to provide essential health services in communities with limited access to health care in exchange for incentives with a particular focus on the sexual and reproductive health of adolescent girls. It also recommended adolescent girls be trained to act as peer mentors who will communicate simple but important messages on sexual and reproductive health and on girls' rights. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We kick off in Morocco at the 2018 African Nations Champions, CHAN. Cameroon are out of contention, but Congo-Brazzaville are through to the quarterfinals despite losing 1-0 to Angola. The local Indomitable Lions lost 1-0 to Angola, whose only goal was scored from the penalty spot by Captain Job. Congo beat Burkina Faso 2-0 thanks to goals from Karoff Bakoma and substitute Kada Bidimbu. They lead Group D after two wins, with Angola second on 4 points. Burkina Faso have 1 point, while Cameroon are without a point at the tournament for locally best players only. The final Group D matches are on Wednesday, where Angola play Congo and Cameroon take on Burkina Faso. On Friday, Nigeria beat Libya 1-0, as Rwanda beat Equatorial Guinea by the same scoreline in Group C matches. The results mean Nigeria and Rwanda have 4 points from two matches, with Libya a point behind and Equatorial Guinea out of the running without a single point. In the last round of Group C on Tuesday, Rwanda will play Libya, while Nigeria takes on Equatorial Guinea. On Sunday, Mauritania play Guinea, Sudan take on Morocco, and Namibia will play Zambia. Then on Monday, winless and goalless Uganda will take on Ivory Coast. And in boxing, a lightweight prospect, Sharif Bogre, makes his return to Sam's Town Live against Mexico's Arturo Santos in 10 rounds of action on Saturday, January 27th. This bout marks Bogre's return to the venue after his recent victory against Jose Luis Rodriguez back in October. The card is promoted by Mayweather Promotions and marks the first event of the year for the promotions company. Originally from Uganda and fighting out of Las Vegas, Sharif, the Lion Bogere, has an impressive record of 30 wins, only one loss, and 20 wins coming by way of knockout. Fighting out of Sonora, Mexico, Santos is a former 2008 Olympian and junior world champion. Also making his return is Mayweather's Promotions entertaining and gritty welterweight prospect Cameron Crowe, who was featured at the co-main event on Bogere's last card at Sam's Town Live. Lastly, in tennis, world number two Caroline Wozniak is into the quarterfinals of the Australian Open after defeating 20th seed Magdalena Rybakova on Sunday. The 27-year Dane took 11 of the last 12 games to win 6-3, 6-0 in 63 minutes against her Slovakian opponent on Rod Laver Arena in Melbourne. Wozniak, who hit 25 winners, dropped only 6 points in the second set. She will play Spain's Carla Suárez Navarra in her third Australian Open quarterfinal. Also, former US Open champion Martin Selick became the first man into the quarterfinals when he beat Spaniard Pablo Carreño Busta 6-7, 6-3, 7-6, 7-6 on Sunday. Sixth seed Selick blew away Carreño Busta in the tiebreaks to celebrate his 100th Grand Slam win. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline Africa Sports.
This the remix, yeah. The remix.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Mr. Maybe, convict music. First of all, you're the type of woman that stays on my mind. Walk down the street, every guy wanna jump on your behind. It's your seduction that makes sure that we stay in line. Sexual corruption, cause I'll kill anyone for your time.
Die in one baby, we're supposed to live like family. Hey, I know the lie. There's nothing stopping me. She the feel my swag and I get money. I'd try my best to be somebody, cause I'm living life. She's girl, they make me higher, higher. I feel this baby, you know, go believe this girl. I die, die. If you see this baby, tell him say she must drop my money. I don't care.
Quand on fait ça, il fait donc aller faire la roue. Ah!
Aliumba dunia mapenzi tangu na tangu. Yasha nipiga sasa sina budi nielewe. Siwezi kung'ang'ania wena sio fungu langu. Yapo ni shida ila nitabaki mwenyewe. Oh ila mpe shukrani kwa kuinumiza suraya. Mbie mibando mututu na ugusa kinuna changu. Nasisikia sirani mbie mapenzi mabaya. Tangali hai kairuki singeti vuto zima mwema. Ni dunda 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 sina mani na saga rumba rumba. Auna ni dunda dunda sema chineti me moyo. Oh, shoga rafiki o marafiki wabaya. Tatizo mi bando nipo tereza nkakosa sipajui. Baka kafunga virango na akamua kondoka sitamwi. Mbaya kinacho ni umiza maneno neno maneno. Mara kwa ndugu rafiki wanini anawapa misemo. Unajaribu babasa wana kama chwataona chochote. Kutwa mikasa na nazidi kumuka nyokote. Dunda dunda sina mani na saga rumba rumba. Auna ni dunda dunda sema chineti me moyo. Nani dunda mawimo sina mani na saga rumba.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. Although the December ANC Congress elected a new president, Cyril Ramaphosa, and there was a sense of unity at the end, rumors continue in South Africa that the ANC would request the resignation of State President Jacob Zuma. It may be recalled that the National Congress last December only narrowly elected Cyril Ramaphosa. The selection of the 80-member National Executive Committee was evenly divided between pro and opposed Zuma supporters. Even the Big Six was not supposed to be overly opposed to President Jacob Zuma. Yet, during January, efforts have been made to oust the state president, Jacob Zuma. The route that has been chosen is to go through the courts of South Africa. Indeed, some South African commentators have dubbed the South African courts as the strongest opposition party. In late December, the Constitutional Court reprimanded the House of Representatives of Parliament of South Africa for having failed to deal with Zuma's corruption allegations and, in fact, called for the opening of previous closed corruption charges. It went so far that the Chief Justice and his deputy stated that the courts have to reach themselves, a matter that was criticized by some opposition forces. Now, in the current meeting of the 80-member National Executive Committee, rumors continue that the NEC may request Jacob Zuma to resign or be recalled. Even the latest news seems to be confusing. Some are suggesting that President Zuma has already decided to resign, and others are saying that he will remain in office until the end of his current term in 2019. The reason for this confusion is that the business community, which strongly supported Cyril Ramaphosa, wants Jacob Zuma to go. And if it could not be done through the political organs of the ANC, then the matter will be pursued in the courts by the corruption charges. This is not a healthy situation for the political development in South Africa, because the ANC are the oldest liberation organization in the African continent, has played a very important role in the end of apartheid. Some are wondering whether efforts are really being made now to change the political situation in South Africa by the maneuver to get Jacob Zuma to resign. This is something which has to be observed, but no one yet can tell what the outcome will be. Definitely, detractors of Jacob Zuma at home and abroad would like nothing better than to see the back of President Jacob Zuma. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Zorniak, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, if you are filled with pride, then you will have no room for wisdom. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Trafficking in persons, also known as modern slavery or human trafficking, is a global multi-billion dollar crime and egregious human rights abuse that robs individuals of their freedom. It splinters communities, threatens public safety and national security, distorts economic markets, and undermines rule of law. It feeds corruption, fuels other criminal activity, and helps fund terrorist activities. The International Labor Organization estimates that 24.9 million people are victims of human trafficking globally. Of these, 16 million people are in forced labor exploitation, nearly 5 million in forced sexual exploitation, and 4 million persons in state-imposed forced labor. No country in the world is immune to human trafficking. It is happening in every corner of the globe, in people's homes, in factories, in hotels, on farms, on fishing vessels, in countless places where one might not expect it. Human trafficking also happens in the United States. This means that if we are to fight this scourge, we must begin at home. That is why January is declared by presidential proclamation National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. President Donald Trump continued that tradition, stating in his proclamation that human traffickers prey on their victims by promising a life of hope and greater opportunity while delivering only enslavement. Instead of delivering people to better lives, traffickers unjustifiably profit from the labor and toil of their victims, who they force, through violence and intimidation, to work in brothels and factories, on farms and fishing vessels, in private homes, and in countless industries. The president further emphasized that during National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month, we recommit ourselves to eradicating the evil of enslavement. Human trafficking is a modern form of the oldest and most barbaric type of exploitation. It has no place in our world. This month, we do not simply reflect on this appalling reality. We also pledge to do all in our power to end the horrific practice of human trafficking that plagues innocent victims around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.